Moses Write the Torah, Examining the JEDP Theory by Alan A. McCrae and Robert C. Newman. A brief abstract. Most courses on the Old Testament taught in secular or religiously liberal colleges will claim that Moses did not write the first five books of the Bible, but they were written by several much later authors and then compiled by various editors. The evidence put forward for this view is examined. This theory does not have such evidence as to suggest that it is as likely as the ancient view that Moses was the author. What is the JEDP theory? It was proposed by Julius Wellhausen in 1878 and has dominated liberal Old Testament studies ever since. Basically, this view holds that the Torah, Genesis through Deuteronomy, was not written by Moses about 1400 BC. Instead, authors typically labeled J, E, D, and P wrote during the period 850 to 550 BC. Their documents were then assembled by various editors over several centuries. Wellhausen's book was still in print some years ago anyway, A Prolegomena to the History of Ancient Israel, published by Meridian Books. We look first of all at their description of the documents. J is pictured as a southern work written about 850 BC, southern meaning southern Israel, and that it has a flowing narrative style and typically uses the term Yahweh to refer to Israel's God. E is seen as a northern work, that is of the northern part of the divided kingdom, written about 750 BC, also using a flowing narrative style, but using the name Elohim for the God of Israel. D is seen as written about the time of Josiah, that is around 650 BC, and that would be southern kingdom, since the northern kingdom doesn't exist at that point. That it has a rhetorical style, and P then is seen as a priestly work written about 550 BC, and it has a dry, repetitive style with many, many details. Well, we're going to look first of all at the historical background of this theory, and then we will come back and look at various arguments used for it, etc. So, the context of the JEDP theory. Well, manuscript evidence. Dr. McCrae points out that we have hundreds of manuscript copies of the first five books of the Bible, all of which present them in the form in which we have them today. Not even one ancient copy of J, E, D, or P as a separate and continuous unit has ever been found. What do we have? Well, among traditional Hebrew texts, we have hundreds of manuscripts of the Hebrew Bible from the centuries before printing. We have no manuscripts of J or E or D or P. This particular picture shown here is a Hebrew Bible manuscript from the 9th century of our era, called AD by Christians and CE in secular circles. Ancient translations. The Hebrew Bible was translated into Aramaic, Greek, and Latin around the time of Jesus. None of these contain separate texts of J, E, D, or P. The picture at the right is part of a Greek manuscript from the 5th century AD. Dead Sea Scrolls. Since the mid-20th century, we have found much earlier manuscripts of the Bible than were previously known. None of these contain J, E, D, or P as separate works. This is a manuscript from the Dead Sea community, dating from the 2nd century before our era, 2nd century BC. Other historical evidence. No record that has come down to us from ancient times contains any mention of such documents as having ever existed. There is no ancient reference, says Dr. McCrae, to the writing of any such document, nor to such a process of combining documents as the theory assumes. There is no evidence that any such process actually occurred. What sort of evidence do we have of that sort? Well, we have the rabbinic literature, with extensive writings from the rabbis from about AD 200 onward through the medieval period. None of these works refer to such documents as JEDP. This is a sample page from the Babylonian Talmud, composed about 550 AD. Jewish historians, we have several significant historical writers from the time of Jesus and briefer materials from earlier. None of these make reference to works such as J, E, D, or P. This is Josephus' Antiquities, the most extensive of such works, from about AD 100. Jewish inscriptions. We have Hebrew inscriptions dating back as far as the 10th century BC. None of these allude to such documents as J, E, D, P either. This is the Gezer calendar from the 10th century BC. Summary on historical evidence. Thus, no documents resembling or referring to J, E, D, or P have come down to us from antiquity. Thus, the burden of proof for the existence of such documents lies with those who would propound the theory, not with its opponents. Literary method. Dr. McCrae points out the JEDP theory is nearly the only survivor of a 19th century literary practice that has been discarded outside the field of biblical criticism. A century ago, it was common to theorize multiple authors and sources for almost any ancient or medieval document. Most such theories have today been abandoned and are viewed as merely curiosities. It is only in the field of biblical study that this 19th century attitude has been retained. For instance, take Beowulf. Beowulf is an Anglo-Saxon epic poem, the oldest such in the history of English literature, written, we think, about AD 700. It tells us the adventures of the Danish hero Beowulf, fighting various monsters. It was once thought to have been composed of 6 sources, but is now seen as a unified composition. Another example is a Nibelungenlied, a Greek saga, German saga, from about 1200 AD, of treasure, murder, and revenge. Some of the material was used by Wagner in his Ring operas. Carl Lachmann, back in the 19th century, thought it was originally 20 independent songs. It is now seen as the work of a single author. Another example is Piers the Plowman, a 14th century poem, a series of allegorical dreams exalting simplicity and truth and satirizing the clergy. This was once thought to be the work of 5 authors and is now seen as the work of 1. Helen Gardner, in her work, The Business of Criticism, published by Oxford University Press in 1959, says this about a literary method today. In field after field, theories of composite authorship, earlier versions, different strata, have been discarded. The kind of analysis which was once thought to have been the particular duty of literary criticism is now markedly out of fashion. The assumption today is more and more in favor of single authorship, unless there's clear external evidence to the contrary. Another feature that we need to think of in terms of the context of the JEDP theory is that of other source theories. Dr. McCrae says it this way: during the 19th century, various German scholars presented widely different theories regarding the origins of the first 5 books of the Bible. None of these theories gained complete ascendance until 1878, when a particular theory, strikingly different from most of the views previously held, was advanced by Julius Wellhausen. Though more than a century has passed during which no new evidence for the theory has been discovered, it is still being taught today in almost the identical form in which Wellhausen presented it. So let's look at some of these predecessors to the JEDP theory. They include the two-document theory, the fragmentary theory, the supplementary theory, the crystallization theory, various development theories, a modified three-document theory. We give you here a chart of various views on the origin of Genesis through Deuteronomy, what I've called the genealogy of JEDP, and where we have a line down the left side here of proponents of generally Mosaic authorship, Hingstenberg, Green, Wilson, Young, etc., and then proponents of various other models, Vitter, Astruc, Eichhorn, the two-document theory, Geddes, the fragmentary theory, Ewald, the supplementary crystallization theories, De Wette, and various development views, the joining of these things with Hopfield in 1853, and Groff making modifications, and then Wellhausen, model in 1878, the JEDP theory, and then some reference to Gunkel and Eisfeld after that time. Well, we'll look at these a little bit of detail here. The two-document theory, although noticed by Vitter, it was Jean Ostrock in 1753 who suggested the two names for God, Yahweh and Elohim, pointed to two sources which he felt were used by Moses. In 1780, Johann Eichhorn modified this, rejecting Moses as the author and dating these two sources later. Eichhorn saw two distinct documents, J and E, with two names for God and two styles. One document, J, used Yahweh, Jehovah, for God's name and had a flowing narrative style. The other document, E, used Elohim for God and had a very dry, statistical, detailed style. Somewhat later, Carl Ilgen in 1798 proposed dividing up the two documents. He came up with what we call a fragmentary theory, 17 documents, and at least three authors. Later suggestions by Alexander Geddes in 1800, Johann Vater in 1802, and Anton Hartmann in 1831 found many more documents, mostly fragmentary, assembled by editors. Heinrich Ewald in 1823 came up with a supplementary theory. He noticed an impressive unity running through Genesis, and he felt that that couldn't very well then be the result of a mass of independent fragments. He and De Wette proposed that E was the main document, but that it was supplemented by J material. Later on, we get a crystallization theory. Ewald later developed this supplementary theory crystallization theory to solve problems in the supplementary theory, as it looked like both J and E materials assumed the existence of the other. Ewald suggested that J and E were types of material which gradually accumulated, being composed in view of the currently existing compilation, so explaining the assuming existence of each other. Meanwhile, others were suggesting that the Torah showed evidence of different stages of religion in different documents. So we call these the development theories. De Wette in 1805 proposed a plot theory in which Deuteronomy was written by priests shortly before Josiah's time, around 650 BC, to get the worship centered in Jerusalem. Now scholars begin to argue that they had found fossils of earlier religious views in the Torah, and that these could be used to date the documents. These involved the view of God, ethics, worship and laws, particularly the place of sacrifice, and the type of priest that was necessary for sacrifice. This led to Hopfeld's attempt in 1853 to combine stylistic criteria with developmental ones. Hermann Hopfeld proposed a modified three-document theory, a return to the old two-document view with E split into two very different documents. One, called E, will use Elohim for God but have a flowing narrative style. The other, called P, will also use Elohim for God but have a dry statistical style. This came to be viewed by some as the Copernican revolution of documentary studies for the Torah. What was this Copernican revolution? Well, J was viewed as before as using the name Yahweh for God and flowing narrative style. E used formerly Elohim and a dry genealogical style, but now E is split in two, and one half of it uses Elohim and a dry genealogical style. This is relabeled P, and the other uses Elohim and a flowing narrative style, and this is labeled E. This led then to the classic JEDP theory. Wellhausen in 1878 powerfully presented Hupfeld's view, adding in the Book of Deuteronomy as a fourth document, D, to produce his four-document theory for the origin of the Torah. What others had seen as the foundational document, E, for instance, in the supplementary theory, but came for Wellhausen as P, the very last to be written. secular scholars, however, feel that the evidence does not warrant dividing the text into these hypothetical documents. They basically see Moses as author. These include E.W. Hingstenberg, William Henry Green, Robert Dick Wilson, Edward J. Young, Oswald T. Alice, and Alan A. McCrae. Well, we want to now examine the JEDP theory, having done that background on it. So let's look at some arguments that are proposed for it and recent developments that help us respond to these arguments. How do things stand today? Well, we're going to consider the evidence originally put forward for the JEDP theory, and we will make reference to recent developments. Most of our citations will be drawn from the Bible and the Ancient Near East, essays in honor of William Foxwell Albright. John Bright, in this particular work, which we'll be abbreviating BANE, Bible and the Ancient Near East, says the critical orthodoxy today, that is the JEDP theory, rested on two pillars. One, an analysis of documents, and two, a theory with regard to the development of Israel's religion. Let's look at the development argument, first of all. As Alan McCrae points out, a great part of the reason for the acceptance of Wellhausen's theory was the skillful presentation of a particular idea of the development of Israelite religion. This idea, however, has now been almost universally discarded. Few scholars today hold to a theory of Hebrew religious development even close to that upon which Wellhausen based his idea from the sources of the Pentateuch. Yet his method of dividing sources and his view of their dates are still being presented as established fact. Here's kind of what the development argument looks like in a chart form. The view of God, the theology, if you like, runs from animism, polytheism, henotheism, to monotheism, and already by the J and E documents we see monotheism, and only remnants of the earlier animism, polytheism, and henotheism. And animism, of course, the idea that the inanimate things out there, stones and trees and that sort of thing, trees are animate, I guess, in one sense, are inhabited by spirits. Polytheism perhaps moves away from that some, but there are a number of high gods, such as we see in Greek polytheism with Zeus and Hera and Athena and such, or in Roman polytheism with Jupiter and Juno and Venus, or in the Norse polytheism with Thor and others, if you like. Henotheism is the idea that, yes, there are multiple gods out there, but the particular group is only to worship this one god. So those are all seen as predecessors to monotheism, and monotheism is seen as already established in the J&E documents, and continues on in D&P, though there are hints or remnants of the other ideas around. Ethics basically is seen as moving from lower in J&E to higher in D&P. Worship and law is simpler in J&E and more complex in D&P. Place of sacrifice, many places of sacrifice in J&E, only one in D, and one assumed in P. Priest for sacrifice in J&E, the head of the family, in D, the Levites, and in P, the priests. Well, here's a statement by Wellhausen in his Prolegomena, the History of Ancient Israel, on the place of worship, page 17. As we learn from the New Testament, Jews and Samaritans were not agreed on the proper place of worship, but that there could be only one was taken as certain as the unity of God himself. But this oneness of the sanctuary was not originally recognized either in fact or in law. It was a slow growth of time. With the help of the Old Testament, we're still quite able to trace the process. In doing so, it is possible to distinguish several stages of development. Mendenhall, however, in the Bible in the Ancient Near East, on page 32, has this to say. The generally accepted account of Israel's history and religion produced by Wellhausen and popularized in the late 19th and early 20th century survives, to be sure, today. It's especially among non-specialists that is accepted as indubitably valid, and especially among those who would claim the label liberal religious as well as secular. Yet it was largely based on a Hegelian philosophy of history, not upon Bellhausen's literary analysis. It was an a priori evolutionary scheme that guided him. Mendenhall, on page 29 of the same work, says, "The reconstruction of the history of Israel and its religion, which Bellhausen carried out on the foundation of his literary analysis, has almost entirely broken down. It was assumed that a document of a particular period could be utilized by the historian only for evidence of the period in which it was written. This Heitner skepticism did not result in a history, for it lacked foundations, and its builders lacked yardsticks." Wright, in the same work, page 4, says, "The historical worth of these documents, JEDP, centuries removed as they were from the events which they purported to tell, was held to be minimal by Bellhausen and proponents of JEDP theory. Instead, they were valued almost exclusively for the light they cast on the beliefs and practices of the respective periods in which they were written, not as sources of information regarding the period of ancient Israel's origins." But we now have input from archaeology on this whole question. Wright points out on page 6, "It has become plain that the narratives of Israel's origins found in the Hexateuch," that's a technical term for the first six scrolls of the Bible, if you like, Genesis through Joshua, far from reflecting the circumstances of those later ages when the documents supposedly were written, JEDP theory, so 850 to 550, reflect precisely, whatever one may say of their historical worth, those of the second millennium B.C., 2000 to 1000 B.C., of which they purport to tell. We move on to the stylistic argument. The claim here is that the Pentateuch consists of four distinct documents with distinct styles. J, a flowing narrative style using Yahweh. E, a flowing narrative style using Elohim. D, a hortatory, exhortational, preaching style. And P, a dry, pedantic style. Here we see in Bellhausen, page 350, the stylistic argument. "By its taste for barren names and numbers and technical descriptions, the priestly code, we call P, comes to stand on the same line with chronicles and the other literature of Judaism, which labors at an artificial revival of the old tradition. Of a piece with this tendency is an indescribable pedantry belonging to the very being of the author of the priestly code, his very passion for classifying and drawing plans. If he has once dissected a genus into different species, we get all the species named to us one by one every time he has occasion to mention the genus." S.R. Driver, a follower of Bellhausen, in his Introduction to the Literature of the Old Testament, also still in print from Meridian Books, says here, "Space forbids here an examination of the styles of J and E. They have much in common. Indeed, stylistic criteria alone would not generally suffice to distinguish J and E, though when the distinction has been effected by other means, slight differences in style appear to disclose themselves." So Driver certainly doesn't see a very big difference in the style of J and E. If we review the various predecessors to the JEDP theory and see how they handle the style of the question of style in Genesis and through Numbers, we get this. The two-document theory had two documents and two distinct styles. The fragmentary theory had many documents and many distinct styles. The supplementary theory had two documents and two distinct styles. The crystallization theory had many documents and two distinct styles. And the JEDP theory had three documents, now looking at Deuteronomy, and what I call two and a half distinct styles. You've got the drive, enumerative, kind of boring style of P, and you've got the flowing narrative style of J and E, which, after they've been divided by other means, slight differences disclose themselves. Well, what about this stylistic argument? How widely can a style vary and still belong to a single person? Consider the painter Pablo Picasso, which we're looking at artistic style, visual art, and the author Charles Ludwig Dodgson. Picasso's style. Well, here are two of Picasso's paintings. They're very different. The one is rather unrealistic looking, one would have to say, and the other, though it's somewhat strangely colored perhaps, is really quite realistic. Charles Luke Dodgson was a lecturer in math at Oxford University, and he is much better known to us as Lewis Carroll, under which name he wrote Alice in Wonderland and other stories for children. One day he met Queen Victoria, some time after the publication of Alice, and the Queen asked him to dedicate his next work to her. Well, he did. His next work, however, was an elementary treatise on determinants, not one of the more exciting works of fiction for kids. Charles Dodgson and Lewis Carroll had quite distinct style between his mathematical writing and his Alice in Wonderland writing, though knowing that he wrote Alice, you can occasionally see in some of his mathematical things a certain quirks of humor there. Stylistic argument is really kind of tricky. Richard Altick, in a recent work, The Art of Literary Research, page 69, has this to say: the determination of authorship requires the gathering and judicious assessment of as much evidence, both internal and external, as can be found. Internal evidence is normally more abundant, but is also very slippery. The premise underlying its use is that every author's work has unique idiosyncrasies of style. Well, as Dr. McCrae points out, proponents of the JDP theory claim its truth can be demonstrated by the stylistic differences among the documents. Yet these differences mostly settle down to the fact that certain parts of the Pentateuch are statistical or enumerative, while other parts are narrative, and most of Deuteronomy consists of exhortation. There's no reason why the same writer should not use each of these styles depending on the nature of the particular subject matter. Similar instances of the use of styles, at least as different as these, could be found in the works of nearly any extensive writer of recent years. We'll give a suggested answer to the stylistic question. We suggest that J is primarily narrative using Yahweh, E is primarily narrative using Elohim, D is primarily exhortation, and P is primarily statistical and tabular material. Thus, the stylistic variation is a reflection of differing subject matter and genre rather than distinct authors. But what we said brings us to the divine name argument. What about this use of Yahweh and Elohim and how that separates J and E? This is closely related to the stylistic argument, as the latter often claims that certain words are characteristic of an author, and this basically has to be the question of characteristic of words, divine names, and whether there would be characteristic of an author. Divine name argument was especially important in the history of the JEDP theory. The original division of documents was based upon the use of Yahweh versus Elohim. In simple popular presentation of the JEDP theory, the data is presented in a way that sounds like a very strong argument. J uses Yahweh, E uses Elohim. For instance, see Alice Parmalee's A Guidebook to the Bible. Parmalee on page 30 says, "We do not know who the writer was," she's talking about J, "but from hints in his book, we can piece together a number of facts about him. He was a man of Judah, living no doubt in Jerusalem. As his name for God was Yahweh, we call this writer the Yahvist, or simply J," trading on a pronunciation of J in German. Parmalee goes on to say, regarding E, "As we do not know this priest's name, we take the initial letter of his word for God, Elohim, and of his tribe, Ephraim, and call this writer E, and his religious history of Israel, the E document." In simple popular presentations of the JDP theory, the data are presented in a way that sounds like a very strong argument. J uses Yahweh, E uses Elohim. In fact, Yahweh actually occurs in all four documents and is the commonest name in each. Thus, each writer of the four alleged documents is admitted to have known both names of God. The real divine name view, among liberals who are familiar with the data, is that the various ancient authors had different theories as to when the name Yahweh was introduced to Israel. Well, we move on to another criterion that is used to distinguish documents, and these are alleged duplications. The claim that there is constant duplication of material in the various alleged sources is grossly exaggerated, says Dr. McRae. Some of these so-called duplications are really different events that are somewhat similar, but actually no more so than is often the case in ordinary life. In other cases, an alleged repetition is merely a summary given at the beginning or the end of an account, a helpful recapitulation, or a literary account, a device to make an account more vivid. Most of these, if examined without prejudice, can be shown to have a natural purpose in the narrative. Alleged contradictions. Most of the alleged contradictions between the so-called sources disappear on careful examination. For instance, it is claimed that the J and P documents picture Rebecca as influenced by different motives in sending Jacob from Canaan to escape his brother's anger and to get a wife his parents like. Actually, there is no contradiction whatever in supposing that Rebecca was influenced by both motives and that in dealing with the two men she wished to influence, Jacob and Isaac, she used in each case the argument she knew would appeal to rather than antagonize him. So, a rather quick tour we've made of the JDP theory, but in conclusions we suggest this. These facts indicate that there are logical reasons for the phenomena of the Pentateuch, all of them consistent with the idea of a single author. Most people accept the JDP theory, including most of them who teach it, do so because their confidence in those by whom it is advanced, rather than on the basis of any thorough investigation. And we suggest that if you're troubled by this, that you make some further investigation, and we recommend some further reading. We recommend Alan A. McRae's book, JEDP, Lectures on the Higher Criticism of the Pentateuch. This is available from IBRI or through Amazon.com. We recommend also Edward J. Young's An Introduction to the Old Testament. Don't know whether that's still in print currently or not.